freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Welcome back, everyone, to Patriot Coalition Live. I'm Matthew Nugent.
And I'm Jason Marocek.
Thanks for joining us today. Our goal is to create a timeless resource to teach about the U.S. Constitution and the proper role of government, the importance of America's Judeo-Christian heritage, and how to defend against threats to our republic. We have an email address for you to send your questions and comments to us at it's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. That's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. We'd love to hear from you. Please send us a line. And some great news. Drum roll, please. We now have sponsors. Cue the applause. Patriot Coalition Live. Awesome. Yes. Now, here's the preface to that. Remember that whenever you, Jason, I, all of our audience, and anyone else in the United States, whenever we spend our time, attention, and dollars with what we call the three-headed beast of mainstream media, big tech, and big business, places like Amazon, we empower them to exert tyranny on us. Think about that.
Yep.
They've gotten all this power because we've given it to them. So we have to continue in the fight for liberty politically, but we also have tools economically, which are very powerful. So on the flip other side of that coin, whenever you buy from free speech-minded businesses like shopping at PatriotCoalitionLive.com, that's PatriotCoalitionLive.com, you empower businesses who love free speech, businesses who won't cancel you, censor you, or call you a terrorist, okay? Now, we don't have everything you need, but we have something for everyone. And every time you shop in the conservative economy community, trademark that phrase, trademark, like PatriotCoalitionLive.com, you are disempowering that three-headed beast of mainstream media, big tech, and big business, and you're empowering freedom-loving businesses like ours. Please visit and shop at our sponsors at PatriotCoalitionLive.com. All right, y'all ready?
Let's do it.
Let's do this. Okay, today we're talking about the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 1. A little bit of background, okay? Before there was our Constitution, there was the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation. Now, the Declaration of Independence, that was the breakup letter between the 13 colonies and England. Bye-bye, so sad. The Articles of Confederation were the Constitution 1.0. It failed because it was more like a treaty among 13 countries, which we talked about in a previous episode, which was awesome. And the Constitution now is the supreme set of laws, which means there are no higher laws, in the United States, telling us how we run how our central government is organized and the rules by which we govern our nation. To make a sports analogy, okay, there are no perfect analogies, but they're good ones. It's in the context of football. It's how the game of football is played and how the referees make and adjudicate calls on the field and how to make new laws or rules of the game of football, okay? Now, the U.S. Constitution starts with a preamble, and it's basically one long, awesome sentence which answers the question, why did we create this Constitution? Okay. After the preamble, there are seven articles of the Constitution. And today we're talking about Article 1, which deals about the legislative branch. Okay. This is, Jason, I'm pretty sure this is the longest of the articles, isn't it?
It is. Yep. For good reason.
It starts off it's very poignant, powerful. We'll talk about that. But there are 10 sections, and this is, the longest of the seven articles. Okay. Recall, the most important aspect of a civil society is their ability to make laws, which in our case protects liberty and the sovereignty, which is vested in the individual citizen. Okay. Other constitutions, it's not necessarily like that. So paraphrasing the great political philosopher, Jean Locke. It's not Jean, it's just John. I want to give him an accent, you know. So here we go. Man is giving up some of their freedom and individuality to a body politic to create laws for y'all's to live by, for all people to live by. Therefore, it's a sacred function of government and should be given the most attention now, which means that we should understand about it. Okay.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And as you said, it is the longest article in the Constitution for good reason, because if we are giving it as the sovereign, you know, as the sovereign authority in this nation, if we are giving mm-hmm. up some of that sovereignty, not giving it up, but loaning it to our federal government, and mm-hmm. we're allowing them to make laws over us, that is the most important thing. I mean, that's sacred. That is for us to know that we're going to have to live by those laws because we're giving up some of that sovereignty. It's extremely important. And so the framers knew this, and they spent a good deal of time on it to make sure that they got it right, as much, you know, as any human can get it right, knowing that we're imperfect. So Article 1, it is the longest, and it strictly defines who has the legislative power. And so that's going to be the takeaway for us today. And we'll talk about that in some length, but just remember that it defines who has legislative power.
And it says, in defining the word Congress, okay, it's basically a meeting of commissioners, meaning a meeting of people who've been given the authority to act on behalf of a city or a state, in this case, a state. And the Senate comes from the word senatus, S-E-N-A-T-U-S, which is a derivative of the word senex, S-E-N-E-X, which is kind of funny. It means old man. And just typically, you know, the Bible says the glory of the youth is their strength. The glory of the old is gray hair, which is age is associated with wisdom. Okay, so go figure. That's where the word senate comes from. Senex, which means old man. Mind you, there are old women in there too. And you typically, I'll just leave it at that. It's associated with wisdom. Now, the House of Representatives gets its name. It's representing the people. It's kind of the voice of the people. Okay.
Right. And the reason Matt is describing, you know, those two houses of Congress is let's read Article 1, Section 1 really quick. It's a very short, it may be the shortest section in Article 1, but it says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. Now, Matt has defined those for us, you know, talked about what the Senate is and what the House of Representatives is, you know, so it does set us up with two houses, or what we call bicameral legislature. So, you know, being the shortest section probably in Article 1, there's not a lot to it, but it's very powerful. It tells us, you know, who has the power to make laws. That's the Congress, mm-hmm. and what it consists of, right? So let's spend a little bit of time just talking about how we got to the way they worded it, and the mm-hmm. the arguments they used in deciding that there was going to be two houses of the Congress. Remember from probably our last episode, we had the Continental Congress was from May to September of 1787. So during that time, you know, all these delegates from different states came together.
Is that the Constitutional Congress?
Yes. What did I say? Continental Congress?
Yeah, I was paying attention.
Yeah, no, good catch. Yeah, no, the Constitution. Constitutional Congress from 1780, May of 1787 to September of 1787. Mm-hmm. And during that time, these delegates were debating back and forth about how they were going to put this together. So they came to the point where now they wanted to talk about the most important part, which was the mm-hmm. legislative branch. And so almost from day one, Edmund Randolph, who was the seventh governor of Virginia, he also went on to be the first attorney general and the second secretary of state of the United mm-hmm. States. he laid down, obviously he'd worked on this during the spring, but he laid down what he called the Randolph or the Virginia Plan. And in that, the part that dealt with Section 1, Article 1, Section 1 said, resolved that the national legislature ought to consist of two branches. So this is what kicked off the conversation about how many branches the legislative body should have. And at the end of the day, it was agreed to without any objection, right? So they did talk about it a little bit, but it was agreed to without any objection. So that was the first idea of whether or not we were going to have two houses in the Congress. And then Madison later on in June 18th, he proposed this. He said the supreme legislative power of the United States of America to be vested in two different bodies of men, the one to be called the Assembly, the other the Senate, who together shall form the legislature of the United States with power to pass all laws whatsoever subject to the negative hereafter mentioned.
And then the negative subject, that phrase subject to the negative, means veto, okay, meaning it's subject to being vetoed.
Yeah, so Madison now says, okay, so we'll call one the Assembly, of course we changed that, and the other the Senate, and kind of got a little bit more detailed about what sort of powers they should have. So let's talk a little bit about the arguments that were used on why we needed two houses, right? So before it was just the Continental Congress, it was just one body, one house, but now they're proposing two. Well, if we go back and look, and again, we have in our show notes for each episode, we'll have the references for things that we're talking about. And one of them we've talked about fairly often is the records of the Federal Convention of 1787. It's, you know, hundreds of pages long. It shows all the debates, all the votes, and so forth. But in there, it talks about when William Davey, who was one of the North Carolina delegates to the Constitutional Convention, he goes back after the Constitutional Convention, he goes back to North Carolina, and he is basically giving a report on what happened and what transpired. And so he talks to the North Carolina legislature, and he says, The Confederation, meaning the Articles of Confederation, derived its sole support from the state legislatures. This rendered it weak and ineffectual. It was therefore necessary that the foundations of this government should be laid on the broad basis of the people. So Davy is saying that, you know, the reason why the Confederation was weak is it was just a bunch of states, as Matt, you know, eloquently puts, it's like a treaty between nations. There wasn't any teeth. There was no authority that the federal government had. And so we need to make it so that it also appeals to the people, the broad basis of the people. It's the difference between having a bunch of states who are just in a treaty and having people who now are bound by the laws and are, you know, remember, one of the problems with the Articles of Confederation is that you couldn't really raise taxes. The states were just kind of requested to pay taxes. Well, now if you have something that appeals and applies to the people, you have a little bit more authority to raise that revenue, among other things.
That's right.
So another reason why they had the two houses, right? If you're going to have one that deals with the states, giving the states authority to make laws or to send representatives, and one for the people. Remember, we had some pretty small states. We still do. Some of the small states, they would have never agreed to any sort of constitution that didn't give them equal representation in some form or fashion, right? Like they had under the Articles of Confederation, each of them sent their delegations and they had an equal vote. Well,
so that's right. So small states like, which are still small today, like Delaware and Rhode Island, they would not have signed off on the Constitution. So having, you know, a bicameral Congress, and specifically the senators, would give them more say in the legislative process. And Jason used a very appropriate word when he said the sacred act of creating laws. If you go to a previous episodes or you've studied or know about the Declaration of Independence, that is a real life story of what happens in a nation that's susceptible or has been ruled by tyranny, when things are off the rails, and because of this sacred authority of creating laws, it's something that we need to watch ourselves. But keep in mind that the senators, prior to the 17th Amendment, senators were elected by state legislatures, okay? Yeah. So they were representatives of the states, not necessarily the people.
Right. And this kind of ties back to what we were just talking about, because if we have, a small state like Rhode Island or Delaware, if they know that the representation is going to be based on the population, and they have very little population, they know they're just going to get, railroaded with everything. But if they have a body in Congress who can apply a negative, so to speak, against the other body of Congress, the other house of Congress, being the people's house, if they have an equal vote with everybody else, says, you know what, even though the more populous states want this, we don't, it's not good for us. And so our senators are not going to approve it. So they have a voice in whether or not that passes.
Yeah. And here the word that Jason said, he goes that these smaller states knew that they would be railroaded by these larger states. You're thinking, back then they had people with big egos who wanted more power.
As long as there have been men,
I'm telling
there have
you.
Been big egos that want power.
And without a doubt, there are two things I've heard someone say. There are two things that are immutable. God's character and man's character. God's full of grace and love, and man is full of sin and desire for power. And
if you go back, and again, you're reading through some of these debates, you will see that some of the bigger states like Virginia and even Massachusetts is a small state. It had a big population.
It sure did.
And you'll see in the debates and the arguments back then that those states were trying to have their way with the rest of the nations. They wanted to. And I guess, they're trying to make sure that they're represented and they're doing their best on their behalf of their constituents, but it was happening.
That speaks to how things were back then. It was 13 countries, and these balances, checks and balances, whether it's through a bicameral Congress, are ways to keep us united, because it is our nature to want what's best for us and for our house.
United through conflict, right?
What'd you say?
United through conflict, right? I mean, some of these conflicts are built in to make sure that we don't just
they're
start passing
bumps,
laws like
they're
this.
Speed bumps to say, hold up, buddy, because it will happen. But in fact, both houses actually have their own characteristics.
Yeah, no, they do. So the House of Representatives, it's the people's house, as we call it, right? Yep. It's representative of an individual group of people that live in a specific area that have specific needs, and they will represent those people in Congress. Obviously, they turn over every 2 years, and we'll get into a lot more of this in Section 2, which is probably in next couple of weeks or so. The House, they represent the people, they turn over their seats every 2 years, or at least that's the opportunity to turn over their seats. They're elected every 2 years. And so they're closer to the people, and they feel the heat of the people, right? The passions of the people a little bit more, because if they're going to be running for reelection, they have to kind of keep an eye on that, right? And then on the Senate side, these, again, as Matt said, these were originally in the original Constitution, before we amended it with the 17th Amendment, it was the state's legislatures that elected our U.S. senators from each state. And so it was removed from the people by another, layer, right? So it was removed in that sense from the passions of the mob, if you will. And also their terms are 6 years. And so it gives them the ability to be a little bit more deliberative, a little bit more, have the ability to avoid some of the passionate ardor, if you will, of liberty.
Passionate ardor. That's one way to put it.
And deliberate on it a little bit more. Right. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So the fact that these were originally elected by the states. It gave the states, sorry, the senators were originally elected by the state legislatures. Mm-hmm. It gave the states their authority to look out for the state as a whole. Because remember, it was the states that wanted to maintain their liberty too. And those senators were supposed to do that. It's interesting because, you know, we talk about how the senators are supposed to be, you know, the Senex, right? The old men, right? And they're supposed to be more deliberative. There's an interesting anecdote, you know, during the Continental, Constitutional Congress, yep. Convention rather, Constitutional Convention. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. He was an envoy to France at the time. And so he missed mm-hmm. that. So when he came back and General Washington, he was the president of that Constitutional Convention. There and so go. When Jefferson came back, he talked to Washington. He's like, he kind of expressed his frustration and about why they added a second body to the Congress. There's now two mm-hmm. houses of it. And it's interesting. So it's reported that Washington says, why? He said, why, asked Washington, did you pour that coffee into your saucer? And Jefferson says, to cool it. And Washington says, even so, we pour legislation into the senatorial saucer to cool it. And so
right.
Washington saying that, look, you know, sometimes we have laws that, you know, maybe are not the best idea, but the passions of the mob are forcing their representatives to do that.
That's right. In fact, if all of us, I think, who are audience of this podcast have received messages from friends or seen articles that say, look at this insane bill that was just presented in the House, meaning in the House of Representatives. They have to get reelected every 2 years, which means they have to be more responsive to the masses. And people are fickle. The emotions change on a dime. It's been shown throughout history, and people are the same in that regard. Despite our technological advancements, people are the same. So typically what happens for these more crazy bills is they get presented in the House, but they're killed even before they come to the Senate floor, because in order they can go to the Senate floor, there has to be a vote of cloture, which means we vote that it's going to get on the Senate floor for debate.
And so even before that, in committee, right? It could be killed in committees by some of those, you know. And we think of examples. We wish it would happen more often, where crazy bills would get killed in the Senate. Yeah. But you think about states like California or Illinois or New York, where you have these enclaves of just completely socialist enclaves of people.
That's the correct word. Yep.
And their representatives are introducing all sorts of nonsense in the House. Well, thank goodness that we do have a bicameral Congress, and thank we have goodness. A Senate who can apply a little bit of common sense and reason to some of these things. So we just wish it would happen a little bit more often.
There we go.
Okay, so that kind of covers where the some of the phrase that came from. You know, obviously they massaged it in their committees of style and so forth. But ultimately, again, the Article 1, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution says this: all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. Now, we warned you we were going to kind of harp on this, but here is the takeaway for today. That first mm-hmm. phrase, all legislative powers herein granted. Mm-hmm. So if all legislative power is given to the legislative branch, how much is reserved for the judiciary, Matt?
Zero.
Okay.
That's right.
How much is reserved for the president?
Now that's interesting, because even though it says all legislative powers are here granted to a Congress, de facto law comes into play so often via executive fiat law, executive orders, and through bureaucracy, including the EPA, Environmental Protective Agency, that says a farmer can't farm in this, you know, 1 square acre because a small part of it turns into a pond for a month out of the year. So basically, whether it's an EPA regulation, it has the same power of a law, which in that little tiny town or and thousands of tiny towns all over the United States, guess what? It has the same effect of a law that says a farmer can't farm here, which we as active American citizens and patriots to say, hey, you know, we need to put a stop to this executive fiat law. So Jason, got a question for you. What do we need to do to move the needle of legislation away from the president to the legislative branch?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the first thing we need to do is recognize, you know, again, what Article 1, Section 1 says, all legislative power is vested in the legislative branch. So if the president is making executive orders, he's giving orders mm-hmm. to his executive departments that are not consistent with the law, he's exceeding his mandate. He's exceeding his authority. And so we have to, and the reason he's doing that in some cases is because Congress has made the law so vague with so many loopholes because they're basically abdicating their responsibility. They're saying, I don't want to have to think about this too much. We'll let the executive branch, figure out what the nuances of this are. And so, of course, they're going to do that. So we need to urge our elected representatives, our members of Congress, to tighten up those laws so that they're not leaving the loopholes, that they're not leaving it as vague as they do. Even if it's restrictive in some sense, okay, well then make a new law or revise the law, but at least start strict. In our families, at least for us, we have this concept that it's much easier to get more lenient than it is to get more strict, you know, on our kids, right? If you start strong, then at least they know what the standard is. But if yep. you give them a ton of rope and they're just free range children, and then you start try to rein them back in, it's tough to do.
Yeah.
So it's the same way. We ought to be making our laws very, very strict. And if we say, oh, it's too restrictive, okay, we'll loosen them up. That's one thing. And the other thing is we've got to, anytime, you know, we have an executive agency who is exceeding their authority, exceeding the law and calling it under the cover of following their executive order, mm-hmm. We the people, organizations, businesses ought to be suing them and saying, look, it is inconsistent yep. with law, what this executive order says, and it needs to be either repealed, ignored, repealed, or the law needs to be rewritten somehow. So getting back to my question. So if all legislative power herein granted is in the legislature, how much does the judiciary have? Zero. Nothing. Right.
That's right.
So legislating from the bench, as we hear, that's not lawful. How much does the president have to make law? Zero.
Nothing.
Right. That's right. And then how much does the bureaucracy, all these executive branches, departments have? They have zero authority.
They're supposed to have nothing, yet they still exert legislative power upon us.
No. Right. So but factually and legally, right. they have zero. Right. And again, so that the president can only make executive orders. The whole idea of an executive order, which, by the way, is not found in the Constitution. It is just a means for him to tell his executive departments what to do officially. Right. All those orders have to be constrained within the laws. He can't just say, oh, executive department, I want you to go do this. I know it doesn't say that you're allowed to, but you can do it anyways because I told you. No, the executive department is supposed to execute the law. So that's the takeaway. The big takeaway today is no one should be making laws or de facto or otherwise, except for the legislative branch in Congress. Mm-hmm. So that kind of sums. So a summary of today, Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution gives the structure for our government, for the legislative branch, really. It says it's going to be bicameral. And it also, more importantly, gives the authority to them to make all laws. It's as simple as that. So hopefully that's come across today.
All right. So great work today, Jason. Folks, thank you very much for joining us today. Remember, please visit and shop at our sponsors at PatriotCoalitionLive.com. And remember, we have an email address, freedom@PatriotCoalitionLive. That's freedom@PatriotCoalitionLive. Send us a line. We would love to hear from you. And if you're already Excuse me, if you're not already a regular subscriber to Patriot Coalition Live, please subscribe wherever you get podcasts, places like iHeartRadio, Spotify, and where you normally get your podcast. Please give us a 5-star rating. We appreciate it. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you here next time.
See you next time.